Welcome everyone to the Auckland Cricket Podcast. We're back with some exciting and controversial topics to talk about and also to get some rants out there because we're talking about the day after what has to be, it's being described in many places as one of the greatest chokes of all time and what we've hitherto accused the South Africans of doing in any major tournament. Yes, we're talking about the Black Caps last night and the debacle of Eden, as some people might be calling it, had it in the bag and it all went horribly wrong in the last few overs. But let's start talking about this. I'm joined in the pod tonight by Neil Rye and PJ Veneman. So welcome, gents.
Yeah.
Good evening.
So let's talk about that and let's try and actually put a wee bit of perspective on this and not turn it into a talkback show in terms of its mentality. Do we need to get really concerned about this? The Black Caps had a pretty good 2020 series against the South Africans in many respects. Should we get all down about the way, you know, they cocked up two overs out of 40?
To an extent, yeah, given it's a 40-over game and we played 38 of them. Yeah, I suppose there's no point beating ourselves up about it. Well, in effect, you could see it as a build-up to the 2020 World Cup, you know, in some respects. And we've got a lot of new players and got a taste of guys like Levy and Delanga and whatnot. Performed admirably, still lost the series, which is disappointing, and the fact that we did choke is disappointing, and I think you can ignore it, but yeah, not beating ourselves up about.
Yeah, I think there are a few reasons you could put it down to, but I think one of them might be that wins have been coming a little bit too easily recently. But it was an unprofessional ending, and you know, people have been saying that it's Jesse Ryder's fault. Jesse Ryder's a guy who got us into a position to win the game. Did he fail to take that opportunity? Yep. But did he lose us the game? I don't think so. And I'm repeating Mark Richardson's words on Facebook verbatim there. That's not mine.
That's all right. We'll put a copyright thing later. Yeah.
But I've been having a go at Jesse. I was having a go while he was fumbling around when he was on 49. And I've been having a go at him and concurring with Craig McMillan's opinion that the blame for the loss lies squarely on Jesse Ryder's shoulders. But I've come to the conclusion this afternoon as I've calmed down that it's not Jesse Ryder's fault. If Tim Southee had hit a four off the last ball, we'd have won the game and Jesse Ryder would have been a shoo-in for man of the match.
Yeah, but so, I think I partly agree with you because I think it's a collective responsibility. You can't just nail that on one person because other people came in and had the chance to do things and affect the outcome of the game after he got out. But having said that, he was the man on 49 who's controlling the whole innings for the Black Cap. Had the winning of the game in his hands in those last few overs until, for reasons that we can only conjecture upon, he suddenly took, what was it, 9 balls to score a single run, lost all momentum out of his own plus our innings as well. Then, once he got the run, got out to what is can only be described as an awful shot. You've got to lay a fair bit of blame at his door.
Absolutely, I do. But, I mean, if you're Brendan McCullum, the captain, are you in a position to point the finger at Jesse Ryder and say you lost
well,
this
no,
game?
He's definitely not, because his effort was pretty awful as well. Yeah, true.
I suppose, yeah, like, he's partly to blame, of course, but I suppose you can't say that, you know, it's his fault that we lost the game. I mean, as PJ says, he put us in that position in the first place. I mean, you know, Guppy, as much as we loved him, he dropped a catch in the first innings. God knows what would have happened if he'd taken it. South Africa could have been bottled for 100. We'll never know. But, you know, fact is he screwed up at one point as well. Sure, he made up for it. But
That catch he did take was quite good.
It was, yeah. Yeah,
it was sensational.
Yeah, definitely. But, I mean, point is, you know, Jesse screwed up when we were in a position to win. But there were other players there that screwed up on the night as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jesse's got to take a lot of the blame. But I don't think it's solely his fault.
You look at those guys who came in afterwards and you've got to say that they all missed the trick. And the bat on ball at that point, any bat on ball, they could have taken off and just head through for a single. James Franklin looked really good. He did it in Wellington and came out, smashed a four to win the game. He's looked very good right throughout the series. I think you would have backed him to have got at least one boundary plus runs to win the game if he'd been given the strike with a few balls to go. But they all came out, had a swish. What, Bracewell missed one, McCullum missed at least one, if not two, I think, didn't he? And then Tim Southee missed one at the end, so they all just went for the big swish. But it'd be very interesting to know, I can't remember now from having, I was watching on telly, did Franklin go down and talk to them each as they came out? And if so, what did he tell them? Surely he would have been, just get bat on ball,
yeah.
give me a strike.
He certainly spoke to Bracewell when we needed, was it 6 off 2?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I remember seeing him go down and chat to him at that point, and he would have thought then, get me on strike somehow, because I'm a better chance of hitting a boundary. But I suppose, you know, we're limited by what the TV shows. I don't know if you saw anything at the ground, PJ. But
yeah, well, I actually pointed it out to my girlfriend that compared to the South African batsmen, there was very little conference going on mid-pitch while we were batting between any of the partnerships, especially when Jesse Ryder was out there. But look, I'm more accustomed to watching New Zealand sides get dominated for 90% of a game, pull us really close to maybe pulling a win out of the bag, and then eventually inevitably losing it. For this game, and I think for the majority of this series, we have dominated most of the time. We did that last night. We dominated for 90% of the game, and we screwed up two overs of it. So going into the one-day series, I think South Africa obviously have the win, have the momentum, have some confidence, but I'm not particularly frightened. I thought AB de Villiers' comments at the end of that match when they won the series were a little bit ridiculous, talking about how the South Africans are working on a new style of 2020, trying to change their style and working on their style. I mean, if your style is to get dominated for 90 overs and then win a game through the opposition's mistakes at the end, that style needs working on.
I don't know, we've been trying it for quite a few years. Yeah, no, I take your point. And I agree that the 2020 series was actually pretty positive for us. I think quite a few guys played really well, apart from that second game where the bowlers probably got it wrong a bit too much of the time, and Levy played in innings that probably will never be repeated by him or potentially anybody else. So you can't, I guess, blame bowlers totally there, but they did probably get a few things wrong that might have affected it. But overall, I think batsmen are looking very good. Their fielding, apart from a couple of instances, was pretty sharp. And bowlers, by and large, look pretty good. So,
I have to mention Sal there, because in past podcasts, I've given him quite a bit of grief for inconsistent performances. He's put two great performances in this series, and it's good to see. Hopefully he carries it on in the one days and the tests.
Okay, so let's move ahead to the one day series, which starts tomorrow night, I believe, doesn't it?
Saturday, yes.
And the South Africans will be bolstered by, I think, at least two players. Well, Graham Smith's arriving for that, Dale Steyn's arriving for that. Oh, Jacques Cullis.
Yeah.
And what's his name? Philander.
Vernon
Philander, I think, is here for that as well. I think they all arrived on Sunday. So that, I think that's a pretty important quartet of players to add to their arsenal, and probably to remove a couple of those players they have had in the 2020. New Zealand, I don't think, is a heck of a lot changed from what we've seen in the series so far. So 20 to 50 overs, big difference, or are you going to see much the same, do you think, terms of New Zealand style and approach and everything else, and hopefully results?
I'll tell you what though, I'm more happy about Graham Smith opening the batting in the one days than I would be if they had Richard Levy doing that. So it's good to see him here. Yeah, I think if we go in, Tim Southee bowls aggressively, and the thing I'm going to be most interested in watching is Brendan McCullum's captaincy in the longer form. In the 2020s he was able to shuffle batsmen around at his whim, bring guys in at three who would normally bat at seven. He's not going to be able to do that in 50 over games unless we have amazing opening partnerships again,
which is quite possible. Those boys are looking very good. I mean, it's not just Guppy who's looking on fire. I think Rob Nichols looking very impressive as well at the moment.
Yeah, well, my suggestion, if any of the New Zealand management are listening, is that McCullum,
they do every week,
they have to put McCullum back in opening and put Rob Nichol at three. McCullum,
ooh, really?
McCullum, ooh, has to go back to watching the ball and hitting it hard at the top of the innings. He's mucking around trying to play a batsman's knock in the 2020s, and it doesn't look like him batting, and he doesn't look good. He needs to go back to what he was doing well. That's my two cents.
Really? Neil, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I know that obviously during the HIV Cup and whatnot, I'm guessing that it was advice from above for Brett McCullum to shift to three for Otago. I don't believe for a second that he would have taken that upon himself. But yeah, McCullum and Guptill as an opening combination have been pretty damn successful, and obviously Ryder before then as well. Yeah, so I don't get why McCullum's not opening. And as PJ says, he has kind of looked out of sorts in the T20s and whatnot, playing at number three.
But you'd also then be tampering with the opening partnership that has been extremely successful in the games they've played together, i.e. Guptill and Nichol, which goes right back to in Zimbabwe as well as Zimbabwe here.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think Rob Nicol is adaptable. Look, I would actually like to see him batting first drop in the test matches, but that's another story. I think McCullum has to do what we know he has done well in the past, because he's only batted at three, I think, once in this T20 series. Otherwise, he's had other guys come in before him and ended up batting at four or five. He's been bringing other guys in to bat first drop, and look, he's just not doing it, and something needs to change. I mean, you don't change something that's not broke, and that describes our opening partnership quite well. But McCullum is a destructive batsman. He can do a Richard Levy on South Africa, but he's not doing it at the moment. I don't know what's going through his head if he thinks he needs to be more of a Kane Williamson type batsman in the middle order. No, it's rubbish.
Interesting. I have a feeling that you two might be out of sync with the New Zealand selectors on that one. That could well be. I don't think that will be changing. But interesting. I think it will also be interesting to see how we manage all the suddenly huge variety of spin bowling options that we seem to have now. Although I guess Ronnie's not in the one-day side.
Which is massively disappointing.
So that was one less. But it's interesting how much they've used what they have available to them. You know, they've got three still with Williamson, Nicol and McCullum.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see the makeup of the 11. With Jacob Oram out, obviously takes a lot of balance out of the side, but we're used to him breaking down and having to replace him. I don't know if they'll put Andrew Ellis in there to replace him. I don't know that Andrew Ellis is of the same quality. I don't know that he's 10 overs of consistent bowling. I don't know how they're going to replace him, if they're going to replace him with a spinning all-rounder.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting to see how quickly we adjust back to one-day cricket against a quality attack. So the way that they've reacted to the South African quicks, when they've bowled a couple of overs in the 2020 has been really good. They've had one over where they've had to adjust to the pace and struggle with it, but second over, then they've really started to go after them and pick up that pace and then get underneath them and really take to them. But people's mindsets always seem to definitely switch out of that quite quickly, and 10 overs of genuine quality pace will be very interesting to see how they handle that, especially if a few are flying around their ears on a regular basis.
Yeah, look, I hope Guptill keeps going, because I think, in my opinion, at this particular time, he's the most adaptable batsman in the world. As far as playing all three formats, he can go from one to the next, and he changes his pace. He does everything really well in all three formats.
Yeah, and the only thing, which I think we mentioned it last time, was that I think one weakness that he will get found out in certain areas is he needs to do something about his ability to play spin and quality spin, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, that might cause South Africa to consider opening with Botha again in the one days.
He is a good spinner. I think the thing with Botha is, though, that he's more of a containing bowler than an attacking bowler. He might tie you down for a bit, but he's almost the one you can play out, like people have done to Vittori over the years. They've just decided, let's get three or four off his 10 overs, three or four and over, and we'll pick off the other bowlers at the other end, which might be a bit harder against South Africa, although Guppy might back himself to do that against the quicks because he's feeling so comfortable. We will see. Okay, what are our predictions then for three-match series, one days? I'm going to go 2-1 New Zealand.
I'd like to go 3-0 New Zealand. That's my heart speaking.
Yeah,
I'll go 2-1 New Zealand as well.
I'll go 2-1 New Zealand, and I hope that the third game is a decider, because I've got my ticket already.
It's back here, is it?
Yep.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Two deciders in Auckland. Yeah, well, here's hoping. Good luck to the guys on Saturday and in the next few days when they play the other games in that series, and we'll talk about the test series when we come back in a couple of weeks' time. So much to be excited about in the Black Caps camp at the moment, both in terms of who's playing, what they're playing, and the whole South African series. It's really good to see some quality and exciting and competitive cricket. One of the other things that has been dominating cricketing headlines around this part of the world and right across the cricketing world is Mr. R. Ponting. And he has been dropped from the one-day team in Australia. And there's been an absolute furore about the way he's done that, what he's said about his dropping. A whole bunch of ex-players have come out and suggested that the way he's done it is ridiculous. One, Jeff Lawson, has said that it was selfish and self-indulgent, I believe, and that he shouldn't be putting the selectors and Australian cricket, etc., through all that. It's a very interesting sideshow, isn't it? It's what do you boys think about that? Is he overstaying his welcome? Should he just be retiring gracefully and fading away from the game, or is it perfectly legitimate what he's done? I thought it was interesting, just my two cents worth, that he called his own press conference to announce what his future plans and
didn't
else
have any announcements, just took questions.
Yeah.
So, well, I think that he should have retired at that point. He said that he wanted to go out on a high, not on a low. I would suggest that beating India in Australia in front of your home fans, ending up with an average of 100 for the series, is about as high as he's ever going to get again. Instead, he is going back to Sheffield Shield cricket to prove that he's still in touch, in order to go to the West Indies and play a test series. I mean, yeah, I thought it would have been an opportune time for him to say, thanks a lot, see you later.
Because he's not now, he's talking about looking a whole year ahead to, he's talking about Ashes 2013 as his goal. So he's not just looking at playing out this year, he's looking at a whole another season as well.
Yeah, well, if you're only playing domestic five-day cricket, you're not playing any other international cricket at all. I don't see how he's going to stay in the frame.
It's interesting though, because you can draw some kind of parallel with Daniel Vittori, can't you? He's now decided he's only going to play test matches for New Zealand, and that's been accepted as fairly much, oh yeah, fair enough, he's good enough to do that.
Yeah, well, I read previous podcaster's blog this morning. He is talking about Vittori being on his last legs.
That's Jamie Lloyd for anybody out there who is wondering. Jamie's been on a bit of a rant on his blog today. It's fantastic stuff. If you check it out, I can't remember what the details are though, so you have to go.
He wants rid of all of them. McCullum gone, Taylor gone, Vittori gone.
I suppose one of the differences between Vittori and Ponting is Vittori retires, who do we replace him with? Whereas if Ponting goes, they've got an absolute plethora of options, really. Yeah, which is probably why we've been more ready to accept that Vittori will stroll back into the team with, you know, Plunkett Shield behind him.
I do remember when the captaincy was taken away from him, which was, about maybe 12 months ago, 9 months ago, something like that, and we talked about it in the pod, and at that time we were discussing what would happen to him, and would he sort of fade away, or would he keep on playing, and I can't remember whether it was me or one of us anyway, who sort of said that we weren't sure that he really had the self-awareness as both a person and as a cricketer that would lead him to just sort of see the writing on the wall and go, actually, this is the time to get out, this is when I should walk away, that he's not that kind of person. He will just be probably pushed kicking and screaming out of the team, and get the feeling that that's looking like it's going to be the case.
Yeah, without knowing Ponting or Vittori personally, I can kind of see where Jeff Lawson's coming from with regard to him saying that Ponting's being self-indulgent. But with Vittori, I get from his comments that he actually genuinely loves playing test cricket, and that's why he's sticking around. I'm not saying that's not the case for Ponting, but Vittori just loves it and he wants to keep playing. As long as he's good enough to play, he should be in there.
Yeah, and I guess the biggest difference there is that Vittori is self-imposed. Ponting, it's being imposed upon him, isn't it? He's slowly being squeezed out of each form of the game and is now clinging on to the last one, whereas Vittori said, I'm not going to play these so that I can concentrate on the one I really, really do want to play and be good at. So,
look, the frightening thing,
big differences, I guess.
The frightening thing about losing Vittori from the shorter forms is the likes of Vittori, Styris and Oram, who have all retired from the short forms or are constantly injured. Those guys they create the balance in our side. Who do we replace those guys with? Who have we got that can bowl 10 overs consistently as one of our top two bowlers and can bat in the top six?
Yeah, I think you'll find more and more that we do have those kind of players though. Rob Nicol should be able to do that in a one day game on the international scene within a very short space of time. I think you find Nathan McCullum is not far away from being that. And
Nathan McCullum's probably not too far away from retirement himself. He's not a young buck.
No, he's not. But, you know, we're talking about by the time you've got him for another 2 or 3 years, you get Rob Nicol for another 6, 7, 8 years, who knows, then that gives you plenty of time to bring through another one or two as well.
Yeah,
I think there are other potential ones out there too. I mean, Kane Williamson should be able to fulfil that role as well.
Yeah, but
his bowling was good enough.
All of the guys you've mentioned are spinning all-rounders. Where's a Styris or an Oram? Someone who can bowl first drop, seamer.
I suppose Bracewell will fit that. Maybe not so much now, but
well, Bracewell,
to come.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about Bracewell as being an all-rounder, but I have not yet seen him bat with the kind of skill level that would allow me to call him an all-rounder.
He's in the Southie mould at the moment.
Yeah.
And Buffett, and occasionally we'll get a 40 odd and come off, but 9 times out of 10 will probably actually just be fairly average.
Same with Styris. I remember when Styris made his debut, batted a 10 for us, didn't we, over in India?
Yeah, he started off as definitely a bowling all-rounder.
So I'm not saying that Bracewell will turn into Styris in terms of a number 4 batsman, but he's young, maybe his batting will get a lot better. But yeah, otherwise there's no really obvious candidates right now to
for well, the guys we've looked at, Andrew Ellis, Sam Wells kind of got selected and then not picked in the 11, and Colin de Grandhomme, who in all honesty looked a little bit lost.
Yeah, I mean I felt sorry for Dutchie. Like, he had what, 4 innings I think in the end, one of which was 2 balls where he didn't face a single to delivery, one of which was where he came in the last over. He basically had 2 shots I think where he was he faced more than 7 or 8 balls I think, and yeah, he didn't come off in either of those, and those are his big opportunities. I don't know, I'd really like to see him give him another go, because I think that's a really short time to
absolutely
be chucked in and say, I'd like from domestic cricket here, go and face you know, guys who are about 15k quicker and an international quality, and it does take a bit of a time to adjust. So,
and Glenn Turner had an article that Neil actually forwarded to me, talking about 2020 cricket and the situation in the Auckland T20 side with Azhar Mahmood, and that it prevented Colin de Grandhomme from getting an opportunity to bowl. If we're looking for an all-rounder to give the side balance, I'd really love to see him bowl some more.
Yeah, it's a good point. That would be an opportune time to talk about the Aces, but we're going to talk a wee bit more about international cricket before we do, because following on from all that Australian stuff, there's been all sorts of controversy swirling around the Indian team as well, which you'd sort of understandable when you've already been tailed 4-0 in the Test series and are not doing well, started off not that well in the One Day series. But just to sort of pricey it for you, there's been all sorts of spats going on between Dhoni and Tendulkar and Sehwag and Gambhir, mainly those last three against Dhoni, and it's been now... Sehwag is busted open. He's the vice-captain and has not exactly been supportive to his captain, and has come out and said that there's a policy around not playing the three of them at the same time because Dhoni thinks that they leak too many runs in the field, so he's been rotating them so only 2 of them are in any one game at a time. That hasn't gone down too well. And then Gambhir, wasn't it, came out?
Gambhir scored a 92 and immediately said that Tendulkar's probably not in our best 11. I mean, that's ridiculous.
It's very interesting. We were just discussing this before we were recording, and it goes very much against the grain of the whole Indian way of doing things, I guess, and also that intense reverie they have for players, that they're sort of idolised, and that they you know, you don't talk out of turn, especially at each other. Although there's been some pretty famous instances in the past, like when Ganguly and Chappell were going at it, that was pretty horrendous infighting there as well. But I don't know. What do you think is going to come out of it all, guys? I mean, who's going to... Essentially, somebody has to come out as a winner of this, don't they? Because otherwise it just goes on and festers and your team goes down and down and down.
Yeah, it's difficult to say because, I mean, we're talking about 3 very senior players in Sehwag, Tendulkar and Dhoni, all with very good records, all at some point have been the captain of this side and have an enormous amount of respect. I think a lot of this is probably going on because they're so far from home and they're in Australia, and it's perhaps a little bit of Australian influence. But Dhoni doesn't look particularly good. I mean, I think it's fairly ridiculous that he's now been suspended for 2 matches for slow over rates. I mean, that's just unprofessional, poor management. And for him not to be able to nip this kind of thing in the bud and for him to actually contribute to it, it's not a good look for him.
Once is keyless and the old overrates twice just makes you look pretty stupid, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think I read an article by Sanjay Mandrekar who was talking about that they need to introduce fitness levels for Indian teams because that actually will give them the kind of excuse and the basis for like that the BCCI need really to be able to actually push on older players. So they're sort of saying that basically they're so fearful of the reaction amongst fans and the Indian public and cricket public in general that they can't just drop them and say, oh, they're out of form, that's not good enough. If they had something which said they need to be up to international fitness standards and they haven't met X, Y or Z, this is why we're dropping them. We just can't, you know, everybody has to apply to that, which is an interesting way of looking at it. And you definitely say that there's 3 or 4 guys there immediately, Zahir Khan, I think there's one actually, as well as guys like Sehwag and possibly Tendulkar, who wouldn't be up to those if they had some of those levels in place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting idea.
You wonder, it's like less than a year ago and you won the World Cup and you remember the final afterwards, Tendulkar's being hoisted on their shoulders around the ground, and you know, not because he delivered a man of the match performance just because Easton Dolga.
Yeah.
And yeah, less than a year later, you obviously they've been away from home for almost 3 months now, when the performance has just gone to crap. You really wonder what's happened, you know, internally, and the fact that they come out in public and bickering to the public about it.
And it's classic BCCI stuff, that burying their head in the sand. They've responded by just saying that all of this is just a media beat up and they've all been misquoted and that everything's fine. It's not a problem at all. If you ignore the problem for long enough, it will just go away, surely.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that their biggest problem is that they just haven't had any succession management plan in place. They've got this fantastic age of era of players who are all roughly within the same age bracket and who are probably going to end up retiring in very close proximity to each other, yet they haven't really decided how they're going to meld in the new young players and slowly ease out the old ones when their time has come, and they just don't seem to be able to want to make that decision about some of these guys' time probably has come. Anyway, interesting. It will surely fill up many column inches in the next few weeks, or perhaps longer, as they try and figure that one out. And actually, they're still doing okay, aren't they, in that series, or are they...
Yeah, it's pretty tight, isn't it, I think, from what I gather. I think Australia's still out in front, but India's not out of it.
We will watch and look on. And I guess if we're going to just talk one more thing about international cricket, let's round it off. The other big one that's been going on at the moment is over in Dubai, and it's a bit of a what the hell is going on in Dubai. Last time we were talking about, we were saying England were getting rolled and who the hell is the best test nation in the world. Well, Pakistanis have now, I don't know what's happened to them, but they've just been trousered 4-0, and they have been absolutely thrashed in most of those games. They haven't even been close, have they? Kevin Peterson has finally found some form and scored back-to-back hundreds. Alistair Cook, I think, scored 100 in one of the games as well. Been very convincing. International cricket's a bit weird at the moment, isn't it? It's very hard to pick results.
Oh, it has been weird.
Pakistan, supposedly, I think before the tournament, they had the top two ranked one-day bowlers in the world. But then, as you say, England's gone out and scored, you know, multiple centuries against them. Mohammad Hafiz has suddenly, gone to crap, but not at the same standard as he was at beforehand. Yeah, whereas in the other format, in Test cricket, they were all performing really well to beat them 3-0 previously. It's just weird.
I haven't really been following it that closely, to be honest, or at all, if I'm really honest. But
we're all about honesty at this point.
How much have both sides changed their squads? Maybe they've got better one-day players. Maybe some of those one-day players should be transferred into the test side.
Peterson's gone up to open and he scored a century there. And Stephen Finn and Jay Dernbach, or Buck, however you pronounce it, they've come in and bowled quite well. Whereas, Pakistan's pretty much unchanged from the, except for Shahid Afridi, I think. They're pretty much unchanged from the test arena, which is, that could be a key point of difference there. England's players have come in and performed.
They very much pick, they're like the Aussies in that regard, that they pick quite specific teams for each different format these days, England.
James Anderson doesn't get a look in, does he, in the one-day team?
Yeah.
He's arguably one of the, top few best test bowlers in the world.
That's a good point. I mean, but we do the same thing. You know, Chris Martin is a purely test player down here and wouldn't even consider him for the other formats of the game. So... Right, that is our international roundup done in full, dusted. If there was other international cricket, well, we don't care, to be honest. So let's just go a bit local for a little while. What's been happening back here with the Aces? Great win down in Dunedin last week. Sounded like it was a wee bit fresh down there most mornings, and especially with the new ball. Wickets tumbling early on, but a brilliant 100 from Colin Munro, his first class century, 130 in the Aces' first innings, basically set up. That win got us a decent enough lead, and he and Anurag Kitchen saw us home in a pretty interesting chase when we had to get 155, which was a lot tougher than it sounded, I think. So, yeah, great win there. Unfortunately, Northern also got an outright, so they've still got about a 12-point lead over us. The good news is that with outrights being worth exactly that, 12 points, plus batting and bowling points on offer in every game, that's not too hard an obstacle to make up. And we play Wellington starting tomorrow, actually, Friday. And they actually won a game, which is unusual for Wellington in this and recent seasons. They knocked over Canterbury, I think, in their last game.
Yeah, they pulled that one back too, and it was largely Jesse Ryder who did it. The newspapers were saying Canterbury cruising towards win the day before, and neck minute, Jesse Ryder.
Yeah, he had a couple of 50s and better than runner ball, I think, both of them, actually, in that game. And they'll have to do it without him, though, because he won't be there. And
No Franklin either,
no. So they'll be relying on old war horses such as Grant Elliott and Michael Paps, etc., etc. Actually, I read an interesting thing that they are potentially going to have two different people keeping during this coming game. They've picked Paps, who has kept in their last game against Canterbury, and he did it when he was a junior but hasn't done it for years and years. And they've also picked Craig Kachopa, as we know, former Auckland boy, is a keeper as well. And they reckon that because Paps opens for them, that if he has to be out there fielding, wicket-keeping for, 150 overs or whatever, they might chuck the gloves at Chops after the first 100 or something, so that perhaps can be a bit fresher for batting, which
it's
is...
highly unconventional. I don't like it.
That's the question I was going to ask. It's an interesting theory. I think Jamie Seddon said something like, what was it? It's a different one, it's a bit weird, or something like that. But, hey, it might be really good. So I think he's undecided as well, slightly, about it.
No, I'm not undecided. I think it's rubbish.
Yeah.
If you're a wicket keeper and you're an opening batsman, that's what you are, and you understand that there are going to be occasions when you wicket keep for 2 days and then you have to open the batting.
It's interesting, though. What they've done, though, is they've picked a team without a specialist wicket keeper, really, and now they've decided that they might chop and change between two essentially part-time wicket keepers.
I think they've effectively given the season away, because next season they've signed Luke Ronchi.
Who's he?
He's an Aussie.
Australian.
Yeah, he played a few games for Aussie about 3 or 4 years ago, but now he played club cricket with Dean Brownlee. He's seen what Dean Brownlee's done. He was actually born in New Zealand, so he's been somewhere wanting to for next season, in the hope of playing for the Black Caps. And he's a wicketkeeper.
So when you say signed, of course they haven't handed out contracts, so this is
confirmed,
yes,
or whatever.
How old is this guy?
Don't know, to be perfectly honest. I wouldn't imagine he's young, though, otherwise he'd probably try his hand with Australia. And if he played for them 4 years ago, he was probably, because they don't really play people, especially wicketkeepers, when they're young. So he was probably in his mid-20s at the youngest 4 years ago. So I wouldn't think he's the youngest guy out there.
Interesting. Good sidetrack. So Aces v Firebird starts tomorrow at Colin Maiden Park. That's round 6 of the Plunkett Shield. Aces unchanged from the last side, except for Colin de Grantome comes back in for Jeet Raval. So good luck to the boys down there. If we can get a win there, and hopefully somebody does something good against ND, then we could be on top of the table after this round. So here's hoping. Good luck to the boys. One last thing before we wrap it up for another week. Club cricket, congrats to Takapuna. They took out the one-day title on Sunday over Suburbs New Lynn, spoiled Suburbs party by denying them the possibility of winning all three titles for the season. Taka got 260 on a very good Colin Maiden Park pitch, and Suburbs were looking really good when Max Montgomery and Victor Davies were together. They put on over 100, I think, for the fourth wicket. But once they went at about 180, things started to fall apart fairly rapidly, and Suburbs all out for about 230, I think it was, in the end. So yeah, congrats to Takapuna. They've backed up from winning a couple of two-day titles to win the one-day title, the Jeffco Cup, this year. And that means that they will be down at Cornwall Park early April for the National Club Champs. They'll be representing Auckland in that. So good luck to the boys there. Thanks very much for listening. Good luck to the Black Caps against South Africa and the Aces against the Firebirds. And to everyone out there in club cricket, just to summarise that, Suburbs still do have a bit of a stranglehold over the two-day competition. 20-point lead, 3 rounds to go. So they're looking odds on to that. So we will update you on that and everything else that's been happening in cricket in a couple of weeks' time. So until that time, take care. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.